We hope this explanation of God's Word enriches your life. To help you understand the audience for this talk, we suggest you read the context material on the About Us page. Please read also our copyright page before recording or reproducing any material from philipjensen.com. This talk was recorded at Uni Church on the campus of UNSW, which was attended primarily by undergraduate and postgraduate students who lived on campus or in the suburbs surrounding the university.
Here we go. On a few questions, then we'll go back to the structure of the talk that we've got to, and then we might get to those questions. And what should Christians do if they have a relationship with a non-Christian? And that is, I take it, some kind of attachment rather than relationship. I hope Christians have lots of relationships with non-Christians, but we use the word in a different, slightly technical sense, don't we, to mean that there is some kind of exclusive relationship of a romantic nature and so on. Now, I think you've got to face the fact that at this stage in your life, any relationship you are entering into of that character is one that is heading towards marriage, in the mind of the other person, if not in your mind. You must stop living in the fantasy world of thinking that you can be 20, 19, 21, whatever it may be, and have these kinds of exclusive relationships without it being interpreted as leading in that direction. And I don't care what the other person says to you, in their heart of hearts, they will be thinking of it in terms of some form of permanency. They may promise, because you manipulate them psychologically into promising, that they're just good friends, but that don't believe them. They may be deceived in their own hearts as much as deceiving you. And so, if you're in that category, then it seems to me that there really is no point in continuing in the relationship, because you cannot marry a non-Christian if you're going to be obedient to the Scriptures. There's no choice. So what is the point of continuing in a relationship with someone heading towards marriage when it cannot head towards marriage? Now, the basic standard answer is, well, come on, you think about it. Yes, that's right. If I stay with them, they'll get converted. I'll be able to preach the gospel. If I break off from them, then they'll know no other Christians and they'll have a negative attitude towards Christianity. That is called rationalisation move one. It's not even true. Grass pole is not true. If you continue with an unbeliever, heading in a relationship that is heading towards marriage, you are saying to them that being a believer or being an unbeliever is a matter of indifference. That the two worlds can coexist. That it doesn't matter. If you break off with them because they are not a Christian, you are saying that something in my life is more important than you, namely Christ. And that life cannot be lived on the same plane if you're a Christian and a non-Christian. There is a radical difference between the two. Now, which message is more likely to see a person converted on? It's got to be the second message. So, occasionally I have seen people converted through their boyfriends or girlfriends. Frequently I have seen them converted through breaking off from Christian boyfriends and girlfriends. Not universally. So you can't just go around, make relationships, break off, see them converted, move on to the next one. Not universally, but far more often than when people have hung on. Far, far more often than when people hang on. Just as a pragmatic, apart from what's right or not. Now, there is a complexity in it. What happens if the person really is genuinely interested in Christianity? You see, I had a dear friend who was started out with a non-Christian boyfriend. And she came and saw me about it and said, but he really is interested in Christianity, and if we just stay with him, then there's a chance he'll be converted, etc. So I, in my normal cynical style, said, well, if he's really interested in Christianity, he'll read the Bible. She said, he is reading the Bible. And I said, well, if he's reading the Bible, I mean, how seriously is he reading it? She said, well, he just started at the beginning and he's reading his way through. I said, oh, I've heard that story before. I said, well, how far is he so far? And she said, he's up to Ezekiel. Now, any man who starts off and gets to Ezekiel has a good chance of getting converted, hasn't he? You know, I mean, that is not casual interest. That is a fairly genuine interest in the Bible at that stage. So, what do you say then? The Bible doesn't say you are not to date a non-Christian. It says you're not to marry them. Her dating was no two ways about it. It was heading towards marriage. So, what do you do? The answer is, you work out whether you can afford it. That's the answer. You see, if he doesn't become a Christian, you're going to have to break it off. If he does become a Christian, you may be able to marry him. Now, the longer you leave the relationship running, the more costly will be the breakup. The more devastating it will be. It really hurts to break a relationship. And the longer it goes, the worse it gets. Now, at that point, then you've got to have a gamble, haven't you? And say, well, I think that he is so interested in Christianity and so worthwhile that at this stage of the game, it's worth me hanging on for the sake of seeing him converted. Knowing that in a year's time, when I really am just so emotionally, personally caught up in him and his world, I might have to say no because he said no to Christ. It's a risk that I would advise most people never to take. She did, and he was converted. He's in full-time Christian ministry now. But you see, he did read all the way to Ezekiel. He can't help but perceive he's going to be converted down the track. Most of the ones that I've seen people hang on with far less likelihood than that, and with infinitely more hurt than that. And of course, the way for Christian girls to get out of Christianity is by the non-Christian boyfriend. It is the standard way out. Therefore, do not start that kind of relationship. Do not try and evangelise members of the opposite sex. Do not go out on the first date. When the issue first rises, that is the moment to speak. That is the moment to take action. The first no is the easiest no in everything in life, actually, you'll find. Procrastinate a negative answer and you'll find it harder and harder down the track. Just the character of life. The first no is the easy one. Don't start is the answer. If you have started down the track, give up now because you've got more chance of seeing them converted by making the issue of it now than you have later. It'll be hurtful, it will be painful, and on the advice that I've just given you, there's a good chance the man will come around and punch me in the nose. I've been threatened by several ex-boyfriends. It's an occupational hazard. But I've seen several of them converted that way too, by punching me in the nose. No, not exactly that way, but I've seen several of them converted that way because they see that you are really saying that the guiding principle in my life is Jesus Christ. They're seeing that and it makes sense now, right? Whereas when you continue on, they see that Christianity is one of those kind of side fringe benefits to your life. Here we go with these other ones then. All right, the non-Christian boyfriend one, though, that's an ongoing problem. Keep on helping each other. Be firm from the beginning. Someone has written to me about breaking up, and it's too personal for me, really, to read it, I think. And if they want to come and talk, they should come and talk about it. But just in principle, what do you do about breaking up from somebody? Because it really does hurt, doesn't it? That is the character of it. We are playing a game now which really does hurt people. That is why we've got to be very careful with each other as we enter into relationships. You can't not enter into relationships because it might hurt down the track. Better to love and lost than never love at all. But you've got to be very careful with each other. Very tender and very caring. And one of the most helpful things is the scalpel rather than the long, slow tear. Right? Good, clean cut. Heals much quicker than a long, drawn out and contracted kind of, you know, we will, we won't, we will, we're on again, we're off again, we're on again, and off and again, and all that kind of thing, which is just murder for you, for both of you, and for everybody else standing around, by and large. If you're going to break it off, break it off. Have it over and done with, and be kind to each other and avoiding each other and things like that to give each other time to recover from it. But don't hold out continuing promises by keeping on coming around to check up how each other are, because that only makes it worse all the time. Just break it off is the way, and seek to have a friend help you. Of course, the further you've gone down the physical side of the relationship, the worse the breaking up is. That's one of the great dangers, see, which people don't realise when they're going down that side of the relationship. They don't perceive the bonding process that they're creating. Now, there's a nice, very long letter, which runs over a page or two, which has all kinds of different questions and comments that they'd like to make. A discussion about angels marrying and we not marrying in the resurrection, Matthew 22:30, if you know the verse, where Jesus says we'll be like the angels, neither marrying or giving in marriage. Does this mean marriage is only in this creation? Yes and no. The marriage in heaven is the marriage between Christ and the Lamb. That is the marriage in heaven. So we will all be married in heaven. We'll be married in a different way altogether. And so the perfect relationship will be established. The intimacy of relationship will be established amongst the whole people of God. So we won't have to be divided off into partners at that stage of the game. There'll be no exclusivity about it. Also, they make a very good point, which I think on response to it, I agreed with them last night, that the people who find the need for marriage greatest are men, not women. And it's a very important point to grasp hold of, that single men, by and large, cope very badly. Single women cope better. And so don't believe the myth that it's all a women's game, marriage. Men need it, very much so. Then there's a third one about going out as a good experience for relating people of the opposite sex. But isn't it silly to get emotionally involved with someone if you don't think that you might marry them? Exactly. That's why I think at this stage in your game, it's too late. If you miss the teenage roundabout of dating, you haven't missed much, it was a pain in the neck, don't worry about it, you no longer can play that game. Finally, it's like one of Paul's finallys, with about two paragraphs to go. Finally, given someone who is single and doesn't have prospects and doesn't want to be single, how should they approach the problem? Is it ungodly? Should they pray for a partner or pray for the contentment of a single person or plan lives around singleness? Yes, all of those. Pray for a partner. Learn contentment. Learn also how to be looking for a partner. And plan to be single. All those things. Huh? Well, it's important. You see, God may in his mercy give you the partner. He may in his mercy teach you how to be godly while single. He may do either of those things. You've got no clear promise from God that he will give you a partner. So therefore you cannot demand or expect it like that. Just thought of another question. Given a marriage in which, for example, the man is bashing his wife, is this just part of the worse? You know, you marry for better, for worse, is the bashing up of the worse. One imagines that in the past both must have been at fault, but where do you go from there? No, both parties aren't always at fault in marriage breakups. That's a myth created by people who want to promote the divorce industry. Some people are clearly at fault. I've got a couple of friends who say it publicly, Tony and Inga. They both claim to be the guilty parties in the divorces that they created by running away from their partners for no good reason at all. There are such things as guilty parties, people who just decide they don't want it. However, very often, both sides contribute because both are sinful, and the man who bashes may indeed be left nowhere else to go by a woman who nags. You do have to weigh it up. I mean, I'm not for a moment approving the idea of bashing, but just because she's smarter, especially with a tongue, and therefore can use a more sophisticated weapon than his biceps and knuckles, doesn't mean that she's not as hurtful, harmful and dangerous. In fact, very often she's crueler. So it is for the worst, yes. Do you keep on living on in it? I think there's physical danger that you don't. You've got to withdraw and try and work out the marriage. I don't think you can encourage people to continue to live under the threat of life and limb. I think that's inappropriate to do so. However, it doesn't mean that you are then free to marry somebody else. So you separate or you return to the person. When it reaches that stage, though, you certainly do need to be getting not only withdrawing but some serious counselling as to why the relationship's going that way. And the man's anger that boils forth in that kind of physical action usually has got to do with very profound frustrations that may or may not be able to be helped. pays to choose carefully, doesn't it? No, it pays to live in a godly fashion throughout your life, to keep encouraging your husband to be godly. That's what it pays to do. Because you can marry a man who at 20 wouldn't conceive of ever bashing anybody, and who at 40 can be a great basher. You've got no recipe for stopping the man changing like that, other than the recipe of continually encouraging him in godliness. That is the recipe. It's not choose the right person. It's encourage them in godliness. I mentioned it was my belief that all we need to know about life is contained in Scripture. Yes. How then can we deal with the issue of abortion, especially those of us in the medical field who will inevitably face with it? This is assuming the Bible doesn't speak of it. I think the Bible does speak of it. On a totally different issue, and from a practical view, can you give an opinion as to what Christians should do if they're at the dinner table? The language never seems to go above the toenails. Well, that's fairly safe territory, I would have thought, down beneath the toenails. But other areas, I know what you mean. Well, abortion, on the simple line. The Bible does speak of it in terms of the values it gives to human life and the value it gives to pregnancy. There are laws in the Old Testament about what happens with people who cause a miscarriage. Men fighting and punching and so on and cause miscarriage. And you see, you are held responsible for the life that you have caused to be destroyed that way. And we're told that God creates us in the womb and knows all about us. And we're told that human life has value not because it can do things, not because it has got an ability to be, viable and independent, but because it is like God. Human life is created in the image of God. So is it ever right to take life? Well, there are certain times and circumstances when it is right to take life, isn't it? God commands, for example, execution of criminals. He directs the people of Israel to go to war. So there are certain times when taking of life can be a right thing. But there have to be the circumstances that are appropriate for that, which are very drastic circumstances. I understand, and we have enough medicos here to correct, improve what I'm saying here, that there are certain circumstances where you really are put into the situation of choosing the life of the mother versus the life of the child. That the complications in health that occurred with the mother mean that if you do not operate, the mother will die. If you do operate, the child will die. Now, there are those kinds of situations in which it would seem to me that abortion is an appropriate and right response to the situation. It's an inevitability. You've got to do it. But apart from those kind of circumstances, I cannot see that there are real justifications for abortion. Seems to me a totally inappropriate form of birth control. And most of the reasons that I've been given over the years by people who have come to me to talk about their abortions have been totally and completely self-centred and godless. A girl came to me to talk about having an abortion. She came from a Roman Catholic family. So fierce was the family on the subject that she couldn't talk to her father about it because he'd fair kill her for being pregnant. And so she preferred to have a private abortion that he wouldn't know about than tell him that she was pregnant. But the real thing that got her was the fact that she was training for the Australian Championships in a particular athletic event. And this would ruin her athletic chances if she'd have to take the year off because of the pregnancy, etc. So she aborted the child rather than miss out on her athletics, which she didn't win. Another uni student came to see me about it. She was pregnant and she didn't want to drop out of her course. The man wouldn't marry her, and so because she wanted to continue in her course, she had an abortion. 3 months later she dropped out anyway. I mean, the reasons for people's abortions are just appalling. The wholesale, I take it's a wholesale slaughter of our community. I have no great compunctions in denouncing it as immoral by and large. Now, what do you do if you're in the medical profession? Well, I think you go to jail for it. That's what you do. I'd rather go to jail than participate in that kind of operation. I'd rather be struck off the medical register than participate in that kind of operation. Now, until Christians are willing to go to jail for the sake of conscience, Christians are going to have no impact in our society. But the day that we start being sent to jail because we take a stand on a moral issue like that is the day that our community will start listening to us preach the gospel again.
That's just the way it is.
Euthanasia is a bigger one and a more difficult and tricky question because it's hard to define what it is. I mean, the turning off of the machine that is respirating people, I mean, who knows what the state of life and death is at that kind of stage. It's very much more difficult. And the technology has created problems for us, you know. Reviving somebody who's had a heart attack, who's in their late 80s and is dying of cancer. You know, what do you do now? You can do something that will revive them from that heart attack, but they're going to live for another 3 months dying in painful cancer. Or you leave them where they are, dead, technically at this stage, although still revivable, because they're so old and they've got cancer already. Right? Now, is that the same? If that's what you're talking about, no. I just think we've got to have a lot of patience and kindness with the medical people and to try and work out the best way forward, because those are very complex, difficult questions, and there's almost no two cases that run the same. However, if you're saying, I'm old and tired and sick of living, please shoot me in the head, I don't think there's any justification for that. God gives life, God takes life. And he wants us to grow in godliness and Christ-like of character. And part of the way he does that is through the sufferings of this world, by which we share in the sufferings of Christ. And so the avoiding of pain and the avoiding of suffering is a self-centered hedonism. It's not a godliness. So, you know, in the classic mercy killing, no, I'm dead set against it. In the complexities of some of the things that you're caught in medical technology today, well, it's a nightmare in decision-making. But on the abortion issue, there are just some abortions which are morally justifiable because they're involved in that kind of medical technology where your choices are caught one life against another, etc. But by and large, there are no grounds for the abortions that are conducted today. No grounds at all. And the way in which people quibble on the words shows the weakness of the moral argument. You know, the terminations and things like that. I mean, the whole way in which they talk about it. But the fact that they will not allow groups to show photographs of what fetuses look like embryos look like. You're not allowed to do that. You're not allowed to discuss the realities, the facts of what is involved in abortion, because that's considered to be emotive. That's rubbish. I mean, we're dealing with facts here. The baby's life is independent of the mother's life in terms that she is immunologically distinct. The baby's immunologically distinct from the mother. The baby's genetic code is different to the mother's. It is a different human being. It is never a scrap of tissue. That kind of emotive language is only allowed to be used by one side. It's ridiculous. I have no sympathy with the abortion campaign. Well, we have to be sympathetic to the fact that people are sinful and their sinfulness is revealed. We keep on jumping into thinking certain sins are more sinful than other sins. As a society, murder and adultery are very serious sins. Because if you allow murder, if you allow adultery, then you allow a society to rip itself apart. So they're very serious sins. But from the perspective of God, sin is sin. Telling a lie, being greedy, envy, rivalry, jealousy, they're just as sinful. And so in our nursing of people, in our caring for people who within our life have had an abortion or have committed murder, we mustn't be judgmentally superior to them. We must share with them the gospel as we would share with anybody the gospel. Call upon them to repent and ask for forgiveness. The long-term psychological repercussions of the Christian friends I know who have had abortions previously are quite large. And the guilt feelings that are associated with sex are kind of like the guilt feelings that are often associated with abortions of a previous time. And it's a great difficulty to get away from that. But we mustn't make it, like homosexuality, a worse crime. It is societally worse. Because if what I'm saying is right, I'm saying it's murder. But I've met a Christian who's a murderer.
converted in jail? Do you treat him any differently because he's a murderer? Well, yes, you keep a distance. I mean, you've got to treat him the same, haven't you? But there's no point pulling punches on it and saying, oh, but it didn't matter, it's not murder, it's you know, let's say it's just a kind of a surgical procedure. It's not a surgical procedure. I mean, in one sense you can put it as that, but that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about the taking of a human life. And it wasn't the mother's life that was taken. And so we're not talking about doing something to the mother, we're talking about doing something to someone other than the mother. You say, well, but that was not a viable organism. Well, that's rubbish. It was viable till you interfered with it, to start with. Secondly, with a two-week-old baby, how viable do you think they are? Your little two-week-old baby, you just leave them out here in the paddock. What chance of survival have they got? Absolutely none. No more than an embryo. In fact, considerably less than an embryo. See, you don't say, well, it's all right to kill a two-week-old baby because, after all, they're not viable yet. That's the logic of it, isn't it? Viability is an irrelevance to the right to life. Absolute irrelevance. We are a long way off love, sex and marriage at this stage of the game. Julie, you haven't asked a question before, so I'll give you a go. You have, so I won't. Yeah, for my... I mean... Sorry for my medical simplicity here, and so please correct me, because I may just not grasp the full impact of the issue. But for my money, I'd rather not know if it's then going to put me in the 6 months of should I abort. You know, if there's no reason to know other than it then gives you the opportunity for abortion, it's best not to find out. It would seem to me. However, there may be other reasons why you would run the tests that would provide other, you know, medical, social, psychological reasons for which you'd run them that I don't actually understand, not having been through that process. There are certain people, though, certain disabilities, that the idea that because the person has that disability, therefore they should be aborted, which really says something pretty dreadful about the handicap that we had a year of the other year. You know, we're all out to help the handicapped, but if we had a chance, we'd do away with them. They've got no right to live like that, which is pretty horrific, really. You know, I mean, it's just dreadful. I mean, even if you use that lousy argument about Beethoven's mother having German measles and therefore, was it Beethoven? Therefore he went deaf and all the rest of it. That's not much of a better argument, because it then goes on to say that only if people do great things are they worthwhile having as human beings. So... go on, brothers. I hear what you're saying, brother. That can be the case if that's the reason you're going for it. But I think what we need to do is change our expectations of our pregnancies and childbirth. Funny, you see, we're the first generation of humans who have ever believed that our children would be normal and would live. You know, I mean, other generations, other cultures today, 50% of your offspring die. Is part of your expectation. We see it as our right to have babies who will have no physiological difficulties. I don't think it's a right of life. I mean, don't get me wrong, I'm for doing whatever we can to be helpful in terms of, but we've got a very false expectation. Go on. Yes. Yes, those contraceptives that are contraceptives, I don't see any difficulty with at all in terms of their moral value. But those contraceptives, which are actually abortive, I would think seem to me to be of a different category. They're not stopping contraception. They're not stopping conception. They are actually aborting that which is already conceived. Now, it becomes a fairly fine point, I understand, in the mechanics of what, how this one works or that one works. But if that's what you know it is, then I think you shouldn't be using it. If you say, where does the child become a child? Where does the conception turn into something that is human and alive and different? It must be a conception. There's no other point you can draw a line. You know, the 21 weeks or whatever it is of viability is an irrelevance, because if we improve our technology, we'll be able to go back to 15 and 10 and 6. if we improve it long enough. Now, I don't think anybody's trying to do it, and I doubt whether we will improve it, but it's theoretically possible that we can create the womb outside. I mean, that's a theoretical possibility. So viability is not the issue. Movement is not the issue. The coming in of the soul at the 12th week or something other, that's not the issue. None of those things are the case. You either make it its conception or its birth. They're the only two significant differences, and it seems to me that from conception onwards we're duty-bound to care for the other person. All right. More than enough on abortion, isn't it? Well, it's not for those of you who are having to deal with it. What was the other question? Totally different issue. That's nice. What is it? What do you do when the language of the dinner table is disgusting all the time? Well, if you're with Christians, you call upon them to change it and have a little chat privately to them to say that you don't really think they should go on like that, because Ephesians 5 says that's not to be our manner of language. If you're with non-Christians, that's a hopeless cause to do. I used to do it in high school and never got anywhere closer to the gospel with them. To some extent you can grin and bear it, but to some extent you can use your brains and do better than that. Before you go to company with people, think about some of the things to talk about. Have in your armoury a range of topics that are worth discussing on any issue. It doesn't have to, not just on the Christianity. Read the Sydney Morning Herald and get the editorial and see what the issue of today is according to the Sydney Morning Herald. Form an opinion about it, and when the subject dives on the dining room table and gets lower and lower and lower, say, hey, it was interesting in the Sydney Morning Herald this morning, wasn't it? Did you read that? And just, in other words, don't react to the situation, turn off completely in a different direction. And you'll become a very favourite dinner guest amongst people, because you always bring interesting conversations in. You also have much more chance of preaching the gospel to your friends, because the interesting conversation pieces in the Sydney Morning Herald editorial nearly always have a moral perspective. And so you'll get to the gospel fairly easily from those as well. But, rather than walk away from them, rather than attack them, rather than share in their humour, change the subject creatively. Could you indicate specific... Easier said than done, of course, I know. Could you indicate specific passages which say we should not be involved in premarital sex? Say we should marry a Christian? Well, on B, 1 Corinthians 7, the last few verses. There are the only people like us, verses 39 to 40, they're the only people who are like us with the freedom to choose to marry, and they are told that they are to marry only in the Lord. He must belong to the Lord. 2 Corinthians chapter 6, the passage on not being unequally yoked. You'll need to get the tape from the tape library on that one to understand it in its context. Its context is basically about being with false teachers in a church. But the household is the church. And so you cannot place yourself under the false teacher of a husband who doesn't love the Lord Jesus Christ. And so again, it will have the same implication. That say we shouldn't be involved in premarital sex, whenever you see the phrase in the New International Version, sexual immorality, that phrase fundamentally means premarital sex, or not premarital, extramarital sex. Right? That's what it fundamentally means, and the old English word was fornication. Dealt with that yesterday then. But any of those passages that has sexual immorality, look up a concordance and you'll see that there's lots of them. Why does God allow divorce? It seems to... He gives in on our sinfulness. If he gives in, why not in other areas of sinfulness? No, he doesn't give in our sinfulness in that area. It does seem it. It's the most extraordinary phrase. It's because he recognises our sinfulness makes certain patterns of life unlivable. You and I don't recognise it because you and I don't really believe we're sinful. We don't really believe how dreadfully sinful we are. We don't really believe that for some people it is impossible to go on living with each other. We can't believe that could ever be the case. You think that, you know, if they really tried harder, if they went and did another degree, they'd be able to cope, right? Yet another counsellor. And that's not true. That's an ungodly view of the sinfulness of the world. Sin is so serious that in the end, some people can only exist separately. That's what God's saying. And so there is the right for separation, not for divorce in order to remarry somebody else, because such a person will make a disaster of the next marriage too, most likely. And some people's sin is so great, not so much that they are so sinful, but their particular sinfulness, the patterns of it, and the way they've given into it over the years, has created
barriers that can't be now undone. You've said things, you've done things, there's no real way back out of with each other. And of course there are some people whose sins are particularly incompatible as the years roll on. So they get on well with other people, but just with those two particular people it's a real bad mixture. So God doesn't agree with it, he hates it. But he perceives that in this world that is the best thing. It's like putting clothes on us. Right? And God does the same thing there. Right? We shouldn't need to be dressed. But God recognises that given our sinfulness, we do need to be dressed. The nudist idea is, oh, well, we don't need it. Let's go back and make it. That totally unrealistic about the character of sinfulness of mankind. Totally unrealistic. As a Christian, I know that homosexuality is against God's commands. This, however, does not stop the way I feel. Even though I would never practice it actively, it still makes relationships hard sometimes. Do you have any helpful comments of a practical nature which would at least make things easier, if not remove the problem? Yeah. Make the great break in life. Come and see me so that I can put you in touch with a counsellor who is very good at helping people with that problem. That is the way. Now, I know that's hard because you've got to do something other than writing an anonymous question. Right? It's much easier to stay anonymous because there's great shame about it. But my dear brother or my dear sister, whoever that may be who has written that, and to which I've just seen, you are not alone. There are several others within our congregational life, and they have been helped enormously by a particular counsellor that I know. And so do trust me to come and talk to me so that I can help you with it. Right? It's not intractable. It is not unsolvable. It is very, very rarely, if ever, it's not if ever, it's very, very rarely something that is biological and physiological in you. It nearly all has to do with your socialisation, with the way in which you're raised, the way in which you've reacted to sexual stimuli over a period of time. And therefore, it is something that can be reversed as a pattern, a way of thinking, or at least learnt to be coped with. Sometimes, very rarely, one in a thousand or something or other, there actually are hormonal imbalances of a different character, but you are unlikely to be in that category and situation. There is a Christian I know who is in that category, and to which it is manifest and obvious. I would have picked you this weekend if you were like that. No one would have missed it. The fact that you can walk around amongst us all week without anyone picking it means that you are not like that. It's just a socialisation problem. And while we may not be able to reverse the process totally now, we certainly will either be able to help you cope with it if we can't reverse it. So, is that enough appeal for you? I really would like to help you on the matter because I know it can be a terrible burden and heartache for you. And it's a private hell you live through. So don't live there any longer. Come and talk to us about it and we'll try and help you. All right? If you don't know how to start the subject, just start off by saying, I was the one who put in that question. Philip, are men turned on by word pictures? For example, discussing sex in mixed groups. Is this a bad idea? Men can be turned on by anything. That is the problem. Yes, actually sex discussions and sex counselling can be itself a great problem, and some people get into it because they enjoy the vicarious sexual stimulation by talking about it all the time. It can be a problem. Anything can have the effect. They are particularly prone to visual stimulation, though. That in particular. But certainly the articles in Playboy can have as profound effect upon them as the pictures in Playboy. So, you need to be careful about even that. However, having a single sex group to discuss the issue will not remove the stimulation for the man either. Men can be just the subject being talked about is enough to stimulate men in the whole issue. So, problems in us. Can you talk more about a gentle and quiet spirit? Does it mean that those of us who are loud, outgoing, sporty have missed the boat and need to swim home? Or is it somewhere
separate from these personality traits? If so, how? Yes, I really must work on that passage, because every time we refer to it, that question comes up, and I've got to work out how to think through the issue. I'm sorry that I haven't thought through it carefully enough in 1 Peter 3, because that's where the passage comes from. Now, it cannot mean that your personality needs to change in that regard. Right? There's nothing. It won't be a personality thing, that you mustn't be an outgoing personality, and that all Christian women must be wallflowers. I think it's got to do with not being an aggressive, pushy, strident, assertive woman, rather than not being a fun-loving, carefree, outgoing, happy woman. When you gentle and quiet spirit, what's the opposite? And extroverted personality feels, well, I'm not a gentle spirit. Well, you can be very gentle and be an extroverted personality, but you won't be able to be a strident, aggressive, bossy, gentle person. That's where the quiet spirit will have difficulty. So, dear Miss Sporty, keep rowing. Well, I'm going to get back to the talk and the logic of it, and you need to stand up, although I notice there's a steady increase in pillows coming in over the course of the weekend. You want to have a break for a moment? Just run your back through the logic again. God guides through the Bible, even in the complexities of our world, because it's all junked up by other ideas. Christians have to work out what the Bible's saying. What the Bible's saying about all of life, not just this subject, and then in the light of what it's saying about God's plan for us, we look at the subject, which is presented to us in the Bible in terms of creation and sinfulness, the fall. And then you see it in the Old Covenant, how God is using marriage and how he wants his people to be holy and righteous, and in the New Covenant. Now, that whole biblical teaching gives you a framework for sexual expression. It actually poses a question, I don't know whether you ever noticed or not, that non-Christians hardly ever pose. That is, what is the purpose of sex? Christians ask, what's the purpose? Most non-Christians just practice and think about it. Right? It seems to be self-evident what its purpose is, but it actually poses you a question that sex has a purpose because it is aimed at a larger goal in life. And the framework in which it's to be expressed is that of marriage. Not that you must marry, but that you must be holy. That you are free to marry or free to remain single. Then, if you remain single, it may be because you don't have a choice. For a variety of reasons. Your wife walks out on you, or your husband has a stroke. And so you are left with there's a variety of reasons why your life may not have the opportunities of sexual expression that you thought you would have. You possibly don't get invited to marry, or you get shipwrecked on a desert island. There's a whole range of reasons why you may be single that you didn't have any choice, and therefore you've got to learn how to cope with that, how to adjust to it, how to live in contentment, how to cope with the sexual pressures. And it's in that kind of context that the masturbation issue comes up. If you are single, though, and you plan to remain single, that's your purpose and intention, then all the activities involved in sexual encounter are really out of court, because you cannot be loving your neighbours and engaging in the establishment of those kinds of exclusive relationships. It's just no part of your life anymore. And if a person's single and remains single, then the rest of us as a society needs to work at including, involving and helping them, because the single lifestyle is a difficult one. In a world made up of married people. But what if you have decided that you would like to marry? Well, there are two groups that are here, those who are married already and those who are yet to marry in that category. So a word to the married already, and those who are not married can sit back and listen very carefully. The person to whom you have already married is God's choice for you. Therefore, do not look elsewhere, but enjoy them and serve them in your life at all points, including, of course, your sexual life. And look to the scriptures for the guidance on how to serve them and how to enjoy them. Passages like Titus 2, the book of Proverbs, Ephesians 5, Colossians 3, 1 Peter 3, talks about the role within the marriage, the way in which a husband's to treat his wife, the way in which a wife is to treat her husband. Never regret the choice, but learn to be content. Work at godliness, your own, rather than your partner's. It's very interesting when you preach marriage services and you get on that Ephesians 5 passage and say, husbands, love your wives, and you know, wives, submit to their husbands. Very interesting. As I say, now look, let me tell you a word or two about the wife. You see, very important that you submit to your husbands, that you learn to accept his headship. And with that, you see, all the husbands have a nervous twitch of the elbow. A few minutes later, very important that you husbands learn to love your wives. A twitch comes from the wife on the other side. You know? Very powerful. If I can just get them to do the right thing, then marriage will be happy. That's a fundamental way of thinking which is wrong. I must seek to do the right thing. Because, this is not the reason, but this is the end result. When I am doing the right thing, I am very much more easy to live with. It actually is, you see, one way builds to a better and better relationship, the other destroys the relationship. While I'm trying to get the other person to change, I am constantly in criticism and negative. And it actually tears down my partner. It doesn't make it any easier. As I just look to myself and seek to be more and more godly, I become more able to be submitted to. In my case, my wife becomes more lovable. And so, it's easier for me, and because it's easier for me to be loving her, I am easy to submit to, therefore it's easy for me to love her, and just gets better and better. So what you want to do in marriage is to change the format by looking first and foremost at yourself. By taking the passages to apply to yourself. Change yourself, rather than change the world. And we're to enjoy serving each other. We're to enjoy our partner and our sexuality frequently with each other. Well, there's much more to say to married people, but in fact, most of you aren't at this stage, and so it'll be wasted on you. One of these days, the Uni Church group will be enough of us married to actually spend some time talking about it. But can I just say a little one word more to the married folk? Do admit to each other, to us, to whomever, do admit quietly and confidently with the right people that marriage is not plain sailing. It's helpful to the singles to know that, because they think once you're married you don't have any more problems. Little do they know. And if we give out this image, this message that because we're Christians our marriage is perfect, we'll be doing them a great disservice, won't we? Because it gives them a totally unrealistic expectation. Christians are sinful people and therefore have to work hard at making marriage work. Not easy. So do tell others that you've got a battle along, and do talk to each other about it, because what happens with people who have got really big problems is that there is a conspiracy of silence. That means no one is allowed to say within the Christian community that they've got marriage problems, until suddenly one day you get a telephone call and says, Bill's walked out on Mary. So well, I didn't even know they had a problem. So then I have to go around and start chatting to Bill and Mary, and by the time they tell me all that has happened in the last 2 years, I'd be walking out too. I mean, the whole thing's ridiculous. It's chaotic. It's hopeless. And much of it is correctable in the early stages. Usually by the time it reaches the marriage counselling, it's too late. So, friends, do acknowledge that it's a problem. It's an area. I am happily married. I really enjoy marriage. I'm very glad. I mean, God has blessed me marvellously. I'm happily married. One of my only sorrows is that my wife and kids can't be here this weekend and be part of the university church. But it's just the impossibilities of life. Right? This is about the sixth house party they would have been to this year. You just can't keep taking your kids away to house parties if you're a clergyman. So I'm sorry about that aspect, but I'm very happily married. But my wife and I fight. We really do fight, and she is a very good fighter. I can't show you the wounds that are there, but we have really to-dos as we try and wrestle. A very strong personality, my wife. Very strong. Right? And putty, kind of pliable personality like mine, is very hard to keep my backbone in place.
And we have to work at our relationship. But it is worth it. It's marvellous. You know, and happier now in my marriage, happier now in our sexuality than before. It just gets better and better as the years roll on. But it's never automatic. Never automatic. And I've got a very loud roar at times. And it's important that you hear and understand that, rather than think, oh, he's a Christian, oh, he's a Christian pastor, therefore it must be just bliss inside their home. Bliss. All right, what about those who are not already married? Firstly, you need patient contentment in God's sovereignty. God is in control of your marriage, future marriage, that is. You don't have to go around like a hungry beggar, desperately, earnestly seeking at every moment for the chance of being satisfied. It's not quite. God is in control. He will provide for you in his good time and his way. Secondly, you must see that the framework of marriage sets absolute limits to your choice. And here comes the famous line that you've waited for most of the weekend. You must marry someone of the opposite sex who is a Christian, to whom you are not related, and who is free to marry. Within that category, and only within that category, can you marry, and at this stage of your life, is there any point in you dating? There is no point even dating outside of that context. And there's no point evangelising outside of that context. Evangelise only people of the same sex, because evangelism is the first step to getting in a relationship that's lead to dating and all the rest of the problems. If you meet a non-Christian of the opposite sex who's really interested in the gospel, they'll be happy to talk to your friends at church who are of the same sex as that person. Be wary of these people who want to talk to you about the gospel. Or not. I'm sorry for my cynicism, but some men will talk to any girl on any subject provided they can keep the conversation running. So within the framework itself has now set it for you. You're looking for a member of the opposite sex who is free to marry, who is a Christian, and to whom you're not related. There's the choice. Within that choice, without that limits, you can marry anybody, and it would not be wrong. Notice my word. Carefully, I've chosen the words. I don't always choose my words carefully. Here it is careful. It won't be wrong. It would be right to marry anybody within that fishing pool. However, it may be unwise. See the difference in category? There's a difference between right, wrong, and wise, unwise. But it's not wrong. You're perfectly at liberty to do it. And given the circumstances of the desert island, you may choose to do it. However, it may be unwise because the person, though Christian, may not be godly and may not be working at their godliness. It may not be wise because the person, though a Christian, is someone that you can't stand. That would seem to me fairly foolish and unwise. What do you need to be looking for in a partner? Well, the basic reason for divorce is sinfulness, hardness of heart. And therefore, the basic thing to look for in marital success is godliness. The godliness of the husband, the godliness of the wife. That's what to be looking for. And as you see a godly partner, you see a suitable partner. And if you like them, then you see a very suitable partner. You don't need to really go much further than that in working it out. It's got a question of them seeing the same things in you. The essence of this, though, is, of course, working on your own godliness. Rather than letting your own godliness go to slack while you spend all your time looking for somebody who's got all the godly qualities. Because if you get someone with all the godly qualities, they will have godly wisdom, which will see that you are a write-off. Work on your own godliness. Wisdom, then, should dictate your choice of partner. And that wisdom will lead you to make choices not about height and weight and intelligence, etc., and age, but about a partner who is seeking the same kind of desires in godliness that you are. Now, because we are all ungodly, all our marriages will have problems. Do remember that. All we're trying to do is minimise the problems. And then, finally, in your choosing,
the way you choose is important. The way you enter into this contract is important. 1 Thessalonians 4 is the passage. That you don't do it by the lust of the flesh like the heathen, but that you do it in love and kindness. You see, the way in which you relate when you're first going out together builds patterns of the relationship which will continue on in marriage. You don't suddenly, you know, you relate over these years and years and years, or these days, months, and then you get married, right? And now the relationship starts. Right? It started all the way along. It started the first time you went out. It started when you were talking to each other. It started when you met each other's family. It started when you went down and watched a football game together, or whatever it is that happened. That relationship and how you treated each other is what you are going to have to live with for the next 30, 40, 50 years. It's not just what you do after you get married. It's what you've done before you get married is part of that relationship. And therefore you need in those days of relating to each other to develop good habits, wholesome, healthy habits of caring for each other, of serving each other, of enjoying each other's companies, of listening to each other, of sharing with each other in the things of God, of praying with each other. You need to create those habits then, before you've even reached the day of a wedding. Now, from the other questions that have come to me in not written form, I have a series of other topics then to pick on before conclusions, and we may just get a question or two more in. Someone has asked then, what is marriage? And the answer is, it's got to do with leaving parents and setting up home together in a sexual union. That's what it is. Important to grasp this, because the divorce and remarriage thing is a bit crazy, isn't it? That is, if you go and have a wedding, I'll enter into one that's close to libel. I understand from the newspapers, and hope that I will be wrong, that the present prince who has just announced his engagement has announced his engagement to a girl who has already lived with two other fellows. Now, if she'd done the right thing and got herself married before either of those two de facto relationships, he couldn't marry her because she'd be a divorcee. But because she not only has lived with two other men on other occasions, but also done the wrong thing and not got married, then now it's all right. You see, that's just sheer legalism, isn't it? That is the kind of pedantic legalism that churches that make rules get themselves caught up in. Marriage is not just that I have taken out the wedding form. It's that I have actually set up the relationship. So there's a sense in which people say, oh, well, I'm not committing adultery because I'm not actually married. I didn't go and didn't fill in the form at the registry office, so therefore it's not adultery. And that is just hypocritical balderdash. Just forget that kind of nonsense. When you set up home with someone, you're marrying them. That's what it's about. There's no such thing as a trial marriage. Can't be. The next thing is, what about the way we conduct ourselves? Publicly and privately are important. In public, in our relationships, we need to be careful how we conduct ourselves in terms of our concern for our fellows. You are very good at this, but because you're very good at this, I need to tell you about it so as to encourage you to keep on being very good at this. I'm not saying this because some of you need to be told that I'm aware of. I suppose some of you most likely do, but I'm not aware of it. When you're with a group of people, you're with that group of people. It is inappropriate, therefore, to spend your time in a couple when you're in a group of people. It's hurtful and harmful to all the others who are not in that. So consistently remind everybody else that you have got a special, exclusive relationship. This has got to do with manners, not got to do with the Bible. It's got to do with the Bible in terms of loving the people around about you. Sometimes when couples get together, they get so engrossed in each other that although they're with a group of six or seven other people, it's as if they weren't with that six or seven other people. And that really is very painful to the rest. And so in Christian fellowship, it's important to not allow your own private relationship to invade and destroy the congregational fellowship and relationship. Now, I'm not saying, therefore, that you never sit with your partner, right? Or you never hold hands with them or indicate to the rest of the congregation that there is a special relationship. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that you don't act in such a way as to exclude people and hurt people by your own relationship. You must be willing and free and able that when somebody else does come down, it's come and sit between you. Because you're not saying, oh, excuse me, my wife sits there or my girlfriend sits there. You say, I'm glad to have you here with us. Because we, you know, if I wanted to sit with her, I could have gone somewhere else. But I've come to church, so I'm happy to sit with anyone who sits next to me. That's important. I think we're fairly good at that, or you are fairly good at that. But that doesn't mean I should, you know, it's important to say it, isn't it? Because the danger will arise. Yep. You mean we need to run a little flag up every now and then? Exchange our fraternity pins or whatever the yanks do. Yes. Yeah, I think that's fair enough. Yeah. Yep. But that's a better danger than the other one. I'm sorry to say. That little cause of embarrassment when you say, you know, what about coming out with them Saturday night? And they say, well, I'm actually going to my engagement party. Yeah, will only happen once in a lifetime, I hope, for any poor man. But, yeah, thank you. I think it's important that people know. And so it's not bad that there's some acknowledgement. Publicly, it's important in terms of the modesty level, and again, you're good at this level, but it's important. It's not only the clothing, it's also the way of behaving. That you actually create problems for other people who are sexually frustrated. And you're clawing all over each other, etc. It really gives other people terrible problems. And it's thoughtlessness, it's unloving to the community around about you. You are hearing me saying, aren't you? I'm not against the, you know, husbands and wives holding hands or kissing each other goodbye publicly. I'm saying there's no demonstration of affection ever. I'm just saying you've got to be thoughtful about the other people around about you. Not lose sight of them. In private, though, you need to be thoughtful of each other. Sometimes of your public reputation. Again, the going into flats when there's no one else there. You think that's a nothing, but the lady who lives next door doesn't think it's a nothing. The woman across the hallway doesn't think it's a nothing. They see that Christian kids are no different to non-Christian kids. They're in there having it off with each other all the time. Same with the college situation. People know who goes in and out of whose rooms in colleges, don't they? And who spends time there in colleges. And the tongues wag very freely. And if we can find the opportunity, if the non-Christian can find the opportunity of putting down the Christians, they will take it. Especially in a place like New College, where there is a large constituency of Christians, and where the people running the college run it on the basis of being Christian. If there's any opportunity to attack, they will. And so you need to recognise that what you do is observed. Even what you're doing in private. But it's also unhelpful for you in that context. You know, you're handling fire and then you're wondering why you're getting burnt. Don't go down that track. See each other in contexts which are above the possibility of question and suggestion. Now, to this end, you see, having said all these things, I come to that other issue in which you are not always too good. That is mixed flatting. Sometimes you are, sometimes you're not. But you see, my trouble is you're all in leased hold situations now and you can't get back out of it and all the rest of it. It's not a sin. I'm not saying it's a sin. I'm just saying it's stupid. It's a small kind of distinction. Would you like me to say it politely? It is less than wise. By which I mean it's stupid. Very hard for the neighbours not to have the wrong impression. Very hard for the people within the flat not to get the wrong impression. It causes a considerable degrees of heartache and troubles and complaints and criticism. I'm worn out by the problems mixed flatting have created to people. And you say, but it hasn't created any problems for me. One, that may be the case. But the fact that you are the exception doesn't mean it's still a good thing to do. Two, it may not have caused any problems to you, but you may have caused awful problems to your flatmates that you don't know about. They come down and tell me about how hard it is to live with a person that you love, but see them every day, morning, noon and night, and yet know they're going out with somebody else. I mean, it rips them apart. So, well, they wouldn't love me, and I can understand that. So you don't know what's going on. It really is unhelpful, I'm warning you. Now, there is an advantage in mixed flatting, that is, men living together are uncouth. They need the civilising influence of women. And women living together do get very catty at times. You've got more fights occur in the women's flats than in the men's flats. And more hygienic horrors occur in the men's flats than the women's. So, I do commend to you the idea that you look to flat in areas that are close by where the advantages of civilisation and in polite friendship and socialisation is helpful. That's a helpful thing when you hear flats around. There's several different spots around the eastern suburbs right now. There's about four flats of Christians living in the same kinds of streets, and where you can actually have the benefits of having the interaction without the difficulties that are caused by not being able to know who's going to wake up in your flat this day, whether it's men and women and all the rest of it. It really is a bad news. Keep single sex flats. Yeah. By and large, I think flatting with a non-Christian. When you flat with a non-Christian, it limits your Christian ministry within the flatting, but it increases your evangelistic possibilities. So it's a trade-off. So I'd flat with a non-Christian. But it does limit, though, that you can't run Bible studies in your lounge room. It's not fair on the non-Christian to do that. But you do meet all his friends, etc., etc. Chris? There should be plenty of people. There's the accommodation officer now speaking. There are plenty of people. Yes. Yes. The security factor, again, is another one. Why I like to have the flats of fellows close by to where the flats of girls are. They can provide that security. And I also think it's good that they've got someone else who can put the garbage out there. You cannot be a chauvinist without being a gentleman. Well, you can, but you shouldn't. Let me pick on a couple of other things then. I'll cover those ones. What do you do about the previous problems you've had? You've done the wrong thing in the past. Remember the death of Jesus. That's what you've got to do. The devil's work is to point the finger at you and accuse you. Why does the devil do that? He does it so that you will lose confidence in the fact that you're forgiven. What is the antidote to that? It is reflecting upon who Jesus is. Because when you realise who he is, you realise that the price that he paid is infinitely greater than the sin you've committed. And when you think back then through the price that's paid, that it has been paid for you already, then the accuser's accusations can fall on deafened ears. So when you start worrying, when you're lying awake and you feel the guilt and you feel the shame, etc., one thing is to come and talk to someone about it, someone who's very discreet and private, who will treat it with respect, because that actually just shakes it out in the open and stops being a skeleton in a closet. But the other thing is to use that as an opportunity to think again about the death of Jesus. Because when you remember the death of Jesus, what you have done is really thoroughly paid for. Someone has also asked about the place of emotions and feelings, etc. And you'll see what I'm saying is, and here's the old dictum, it's a good one, not the Bible one, it's a good one. Emotions are a wonderful servant and a terrible master. Because you're afraid of them mastering you, don't deny them, because they're wonderful servants. They really, it's marvellous to be emotional. I'm a massively emotional person. I love my emotions. It's wonderful. But I'm not going to be run by them. Enjoy them without being run by them, you see, is the art of it. We tend to think, this dreadful line, I fell in love, I'm totally in love with him, therefore I must nothing. Just because you feel something doesn't mean that you necessarily have to do anything. You don't have to be true to your emotions. Emotions frequently follow facts. They are like the steam on the bubbling water.
That they actually only come when the water's boiled up. That you actually put the water back in the fridge and let it cool down, the steam will stop coming off. So that if you enter into a relationship, after a while you will develop certain emotions. You cut out of that relationship, and after a while those emotions will change. The emotions follow the facts. So to make decisions on the basis of the emotions is often wrong. Marvellous servants, terrible masters. Now, there's one last comment that's come back to me from the way I handled one question last night when I was most likely tired and worn out and you were, just about the role of women. I did sound a little unsympathetic. My facetiousness gets the better of me eventually. Let me say just a couple of words about it, because I really am sympathetic to a very big problem at a university church. Most of the girls here have been socialised in two contradictory patterns. From a little childhood, you've been given babies to play with. You were one who was the mother when you played mothers and brothers with your brother. Mother and fathers with your brother, then you were the one that played the mother, usually. And the whole program has been towards marriage. And as you step down the 20s and move towards the 30s, your parents will press the matter even further. Yet, because you were clever girls, you kept on passing exams and people kept on reinforcing how wonderful it was that you were clever and how this day and age you can be a doctor, you can be a lawyer, you can be a professor, and have encouraged you on in your academic pursuit into the career of a professional. Hardly anybody has actually sat down with you and analysed with you the capacity for anybody to hold together those two plans, ideals, programs, hopes, aspirations. The only people who do it are Pole Magazine, Clio, 18, whatever those other names are, right? And they constantly say, you can have both. I have been ministering to professional women now for the last decade, and I can assure you, you can't. The one or two extraordinary characters and personalities who have got so much energy they could organise the United Nations with one hand tied behind their back, sometimes can seem to keep their head above water, looking after preschoolers and developing a career. But I haven't met one this weekend who is like it. With all due respect to you, I haven't met everybody here, so maybe you're the one that I haven't met, but, you know, those kinds of people are just out of this world. They are weirdos, right? And you're not. You won't be able to hold it together. Just spend some time with a young mother and re-evaluate what mothering involves. It's a full-time job, especially when the kids are little ones. And you can't take 10, 15 years out of your life to raise your kids and expect the same career success as the person who was at it the whole time. And the idea of postponing your kids till you're in your 30s is a disaster area, not only physiologically, but psychologically. Your capacity for coping with babies when you've been a successful career woman up until 35, you won't have a capacity for it. It requires a total readjustment of life that you really will be very unsuited for. The two don't hold together. Now, that means that you have a problem. It's a very real problem, and therefore I shouldn't make light like I did last night and make fun of the question that comes in, because it's a very real and significant problem that you're battling with, and we need to talk about together, because hardly anybody else is talking about it. And nobody is coming out and being honest like I do and say you won't be able to make it. You've got to actually make the choices about what you want to do. If you want to be single and have a career, that's perfectly your privilege and right, and do it. But if you think you'll be able to combine it with marriage, I suggest to you, you most likely won't be able to. Now, I know that there are rare exceptions. Husbands who want to look after babies and things like that. But they are so exceptional, we deal with them privately. I think a devastating effect. Now, there's a difficulty, because half of you come from homes where your mother is working. But I'm actually against it. The children are more important. You are against it too, actually, when you think about it. See, the children are more important, and most people rationalise working in terms of, I'm doing it for the sake of having the money for the children. But what do you want from your parents? Their money? Or their listening? Their relationship. Listening
takes time. It takes being available. The most magic moment in our family is the hour or so after school, that first half hour after school. Because the kids come home and they bubble out everything that's happened all day. If you don't catch them then, you've missed them. By the time they settle down, started doing their homework, watch some television, kick the ball outside, had a bath, gone to eat tea, it's all gone. It's all gone. But to listen to them each afternoon when they get home from school builds a relationship for a lifetime. Helps us through the difficult patches. You can't do that unless you're available. Yeah, but I've got a job which will allow me to be home at that half hour. It's still a pharisaism. It just takes time. Parenting takes time. Now, Christians will do it because Christians are committed to people. Non-Christians won't do it because they're committed to making money for themselves. Having only one income in a family means that you live a poorer standard of life than those around about you. But I am earning a salary which I think is below or on a par with whatever salary you will earn when you first leave university. And I've got a family of three children and a wife who are all dependent upon that salary. And frankly, friends, we live very comfortably. We don't smoke, we don't drink, we don't gamble. So a lot of the finances that other people, you know, the other things that people spend their money on, we don't have to spend their money on, but we live very comfortably. We don't have all the latest in everything, but we live very comfortably. My kids don't go to the best private school, they go to a public school. But that's all right, they're clever kids, they'll survive. You know, education's not everything. Yep. Well, it's got to do then with my problem with careerism. You see, I actually don't believe in men getting into careers either. Because I think preaching the gospel is more important. And so I want to get as many people out of work as possible so they can get into ministering the gospel. Anyway, and Midgie Conference deals with this in a big way. And so, you know, my wife, our kids are getting off her hands, you know. I mean, the last one's now in third class primary school, so they're pretty well getting off our hands in many ways. She can get and do lots of things that she couldn't do a few years ago. And as a result, there's now a ladies' Bible study with 50 women coming and 30 children every Thursday morning. And she's involved in this massive ministry amongst young mothers. Now, we could say, well, look, let's not do that. Let's go back to school. She's a very effective and good high school teacher. And she could be earning more money back high school teaching than I'm earning. But why on earth would we want to do it? If we wanted to make money, I wouldn't be in the ministry anyway. I'd be doing something completely different. I mean, we've given up money hunting in order to minister. She's not going to go back to work to chase money. Andrew, it's the last one because I'm about to catch a train. Yes. The great principle of loving your wife is that she always gets her way. Now, if that's being second rate, I wish the politicians would treat me like that. See, in the end, she will do whatever he says. And in the end, what he says is, we'll do it your way. Now, who wins? The man is under the commitment to treat her like a queen. All she has to do is submit to it.
Thank you for listening to the talks on philipjensen.com. Please check our copyright page before recording or reproducing any material on philipjensen.com.